Well, I changed the song on there just because I really liked that song and I wanted to hear it. Also, my talk is a little bit about singing this morning, especially singing in heaven. Did anyone recognize those verses that Rodney read? The first part of something. No, you might not. The first part of something that's called the Song of Moses. My talk this morning is going to be about the Song of Moses. And I'm going to be reading from Deuteronomy 31 and 32 if you want to follow along in your Bible. When I was preparing my talk, I wasn't quite sure why I was thinking of the Song of Moses. There was something that had brought it to my attention, and I had read it and thought, I want to do a talk on this a little bit. So I thought it was probably something in singing, because in the song books you have those headings to the top and they reference different verses. And so I thought it was probably that, until this morning in class in Revelations. And then I remembered that's where I had seen it, because Mark had mentioned the Song of Moses and it was in Revelations. It talks about in heaven them singing the Song of Moses. But we'll get to that later. So I want to talk about the Song of Moses. We're going to talk a little bit about it. I'm going to read some of it, but not all of it, and we'll see where we go with it. So the context of the story. We have Moses. He's at the end of his journeys, and he's at the end of his life. The people of Israel are about ready to cross over into the Promised Land. They finally got where they've been going after 40 years of wandering. They're going to go there, but of course, Moses can't go. He's not allowed to go into the Promised Land because of the sin he did in the wilderness of Zin. He didn't give God the glory for giving them something to drink. He took the glory himself, and so God says, because you didn't sanctify me with this, you won't go in. So the Israelites must go in alone, I guess, if you want to call it that, without Moses. So he's going to prepare them. He has to prepare them for what's going over. God needs to prepare them, and Moses is going to do that. So there's some things that have to be done before they cross over. First, they need a new leader. So Joshua is going to be appointed as their leader. He's been proven faithful and obedient to God, so he's a good man to put into the job. So he's appointed the leader. And next, Moses reads the law to them again. He gives them the law, gives them the book of the law, it's put in the Ark of the Covenant. And he instructs them that it has to be read every 7 years during the Feast of Tabernacles. They're to be read before all the people that are gathered together, and they're going to read the law because they need to know who their God is. They need to remember who he is. They need to remember how to worship him. Remembering is so important to us and to them at that time. They got to remember who their God is. So the law is to be read to them every 7 years. Next, he has to write this song, and he has to teach it to the people. I just read it to them. He has to teach it to them. They have to know it. They have to be able to remember it. They have to be able to sing it themselves. There's no instruction on when they have to sing it or any time like that, just that they have to know it. They have to be taught the song. Then Moses gives them this special blessing, the blessing of Moses. And finally, he departs. He goes up on Mount Nebo. God shows him all the land that he's not going to get to go into, and there he dies. So although Moses wrote the song, he did it in God's direction. God told him what to say, because it's going to be very important. Like the law, the song was given by God. God knows what's ahead for the Israelites. He knows what's going to happen to them. Despite all of his instructions, he knows what they're going to do. So he's got to prepare them for it. He reveals to Moses that the Israelites are going to stray away from him. They're going to start worshiping other gods. They're going to disobey his commandments and disobey everything he's told them to do. They'll forsake him and they'll break the covenant that they made with him. So he tells Moses that then, I'm going to turn away from them. When they break the covenant, I'm no longer held by it. So I'm going to turn my face away from them and I'm going to let other nations come in and persecute them, and they're going to see what happens when they don't worship me. Troubled times will fall on them and their enemies will reign over them. So this is not a very happy story. What's even worse is God is telling Moses all these things. Joshua, the new leader, is standing right there. He's with them. So he hears what's going to happen. I'm the new leader, and now all this is going to happen? Thanks a lot. What a great first day on the job. So how could he fill those shoes? He's going to replace Moses. What a great story. Doesn't really tell what Joshua's reaction was, but I'm sure he was up to it, or God would not have put him in that place. So let's look at Deuteronomy now. We're going to read a little bit. Deuteronomy 31, 14 through 18. And the Lord said to Moses, behold, the days approach that thou must die. Call Joshua and present yourself in the tabernacle of the congregation, that I may give him a charge. And Moses and Joshua went and presented themselves in the tabernacle of the congregation. And the Lord appeared in the tabernacle in a pillar of a cloud, and the pillar of the cloud stood over the door of the tabernacle. And the Lord said to Moses, behold, You will sleep with your fathers, and this people will rise up and go a-whoring after the gods of the strangers of the land, whither they go to be among them, and will forsake me, and break my covenant which I have made with them. Then my anger shall be kindled against them in that day, and I will forsake them, and I will hide my face from them, and they shall be devoured. And many evils and troubles shall befall them, so that they will say in that day, Are not these evils come upon us, because our God is not among us? And I will surely hide my face in that day for all the evils which they have wrought, in that they have turned unto other gods. So next God instructs Moses what he's to do. Now therefore write this song for you, and teach it to the children of Israel. Put it in their mouths, that this song may be a witness for me against the children of Israel. For when I shall have brought them into the land which I swore unto their fathers, that flows with milk and honey, and they shall have eaten and filled themselves and waxen fat, then will they turn unto other gods and serve them, and provoke me, and break my covenant. And it shall come to pass, when many evils and troubles are befallen them, that this song shall testify against them as a witness. For it shall not be forgotten out of the mouths of their seed. For I know their imaginations which they go about even now, before I have brought them into the land which I swore. Moses therefore wrote this song the same day and taught it to the children of Israel. So Moses teaches them the song. When I first ran across this, it got me thinking kind of off on a sidetrack. It got me thinking about singing. Singing. Singing is so very important. I remember reading the story. I mean, we have children's class up here. We go through this a couple of times. I've been through this cycle with Nathan. And I remember reading this story, and I'm not sure why. Maybe we skip across it because it's this song of Moses, and maybe we're more focused on teaching him other things. But I'm not sure we should be skipping it because it has a very important point. But it starts me thinking about singing, and when was singing first brought into the worship service? I mean, when was worshiping God in song first mentioned in the scriptures? So I wanted to look around. So in Genesis 31, we find some references to singing. Of course, I was looking in the King James Version, so in other versions you might find other things. But in 31, I find some references to singing, but it's not about worshiping God. It's about Jacob and Laban, and they're talking about basically a farewell party and stuff. So that wasn't what I was looking for. The first reference I could find was in Exodus 15. We have the Israelites had just crossed the Red Sea. They had just witnessed the destruction of Pharaoh's army by God. And they were saved from certain death in the desert. So they were praising God for their victory, for their salvation. Exodus 15, 1 and 2 says, Then Moses and the Israelites sang this song to the Lord. I will sing to the Lord, for he is highly exalted. The horse and its rider he has hurled into the sea. The Lord is my strength and my song. He has become my salvation. He is my God, and I will praise him, my father's God, and I will exalt him. The Lord is my strength and my song. Remember that, please, for a little later. So the next reference I find to singing praises was just a little further down Exodus. Well, this time it's not a good thing, because the praises are not directed to God. They're directed to an idol, a golden calf made by Aaron. And there's Israelites, while Moses was off on the mountain getting the law. So this was singing in worship, but it was bad singing in worship. So that's a good point we need to remember. We can sing and worship to the Lord, and we can do it correctly, and God accepts it, and it's wonderful. But we can sing incorrectly. We can sing in blasphemy. We can sing worthlessly, however you want to say it. Remember that when we sing to the Lord, it has to be in worship. It has to be correct. So there's many other references to singing. Of course, Psalms is a whole book of songs dedicated to the Lord, dedicated to praising God. And of course, we have singing in heaven. In Revelations, we find singing in heaven, much reference to singing in heaven. So it's a very important way of praising God. We have to remember that. It's something that we need to have in our worship service, something we need to do. Singing in praises to God is part of our worship. It's part of us. Okay, let's go back to the Song of Moses now. Rodney read the first 12 verses, and those 12 verses were important because they talk about the beginning. They talk about this section where God is praising his saying how great he is, and he can do that. And he's talking about Jacob, the beginning of the Israelites as a nation. Talking about Jacob and about protecting him, and about Jacob worshiping him, and about the dividing of the nations into the tribes. And those are all good things. Then it turns. Let's go to verse 15, 32, 32:15. But Jeshurun waxed fat, and Jeshurun is his poetic name for Israel. But Jeshurun waxed fat and kicked. Thou art waxen fat, thou art grown thick, thou art covered with fatness. Then he forsook God which made him, and lightly esteemed the rock of his salvation. They provoked him to jealousy with strange gods, with abominations provoked they him to anger. They sacrificed unto devils, not to God, to gods whom they knew not, to new gods that came newly up, whom your fathers feared not. Of the rock that begat thee thou art unmindful, and hast forgotten God that formed thee. When the Lord saw it, he abhorred them, because of the provoking of his sons and of his daughters. And he said, I will hide my face from them. I will see what their end shall be, for they are a very froward generation, children in whom is no faith. They have moved me to jealousy with that which is not God. They provoked me to anger with their vanities. I will move them to jealousy with those which are not a people. I will provoke them to anger with a foolish nation. Okay, this is the words he's teaching them to say, teaching them to remember. So when I read this passage, I think about, of course, what's to come. Over and over and over, the Israelites fall away. But I also think about, it's not just for that time. It's for all times, I guess. I think about today. Doesn't this sound like today to you? Talks about them growing fat, society that becomes too comfortable, too lazy, too complacent, about them forsaking God, or forgotten God that formed them, people who have no time for God, they worship when it's convenient for them, or they don't even bother showing up, they just have no God in their lives. They lightly esteem the rock of his salvation. They're unmindful of the rock that begat thee. When I see salvation, the rock of salvation, it may refer to God, but I always think of Jesus. They lightly esteem Jesus. They don't put the emphasis on him that he needs for what he did for them. They sacrifice not to God. They don't have God in their lives. They're atheists, or it's just not there. Not that they don't believe, it's just there's no purpose there. Or they sacrifice to new gods. You have Islam. We have other gods. New Age religion. These other things that come up to take the place of God. He talks about, move me to jealousy with that which is not God. Provoke me to anger with their vanities. Things that are not God, that have become our God. Physical things, cars, jobs, houses, ourselves. Things that are not God. The vanities of life. I think of the term secular humanism comes to my mind, which I always translate to me as man elevated to the point of God. Secular humanism is now man is God. There is no God. We are our own God. It says, I will provoke them to anger with a foolish nation. God used other nations to punish them for their disobedience. He wanted to show them why they were wrong. He allowed them to be attacked and defeated in battles to show that they were not worshiping him correctly. It was a way to get their attention, to get them back on track. There are some who profess this still happens today. Some who believe that God is using other nations to attack the United States, other groups to attack the United States in punishment because of our political views, or in punishment because of our immoral society or immoral conduct. They believe that God is punishing the United States for its political policies and social morals. To believe that, though, I think you'd have to believe that somehow the U.S. has become the chosen nation to replace Israel, which it has not. And there are some, I hate to get off on too much of a political point, there are some who pick at the funeral of soldiers because they figure those soldiers are being punished because of our nation. And it's just so absurd to me, it makes me angry to think that people believe that. But they point to these verses and say, see, right here it says, this is what it is. It makes me angry. But I see great similarities between the future of what is for Israelites and the future of us today, or the present today. That's why this song is very important, because it's not just for them, it's for all time. These aren't just stories that are taught in the Old Testament. They're lessons for us to learn. That's why we have them there. We need to look at those lessons and then look at ourselves today and say, how is this similar? Why is it similar? What can we do to not be in the same situation? To avoid making the same mistakes. And then perhaps the most interesting thing in this is God's purpose for the song. And he tells us what his purpose is. We have this very brief oral history of the Israelite, Jacob and the divide of the nations. They talk about his care, they talk about what happens to them, and in the end talk about his salvation. We'll get to that. How they come back and they're pulled back in. Deuteronomy 32, 26 through 29. I said I would scatter them into corners. I would make the remembrance of them to cease from among men, were it not that I feared the wrath or the taunts of the enemy, lest their adversaries should behave themselves strangely, and lest they should say, Our hand is high, and the Lord hath not done all this. For they are a nation void of counsel, neither is there any understanding in them. Oh, that they were wise, that they understand this, and that they would consider their latter end. Oh, that they were wise. Oh, that they would see what's happening, and they would change their ways. So he says, I'm going to do this, but I can't go all the way, because the enemy will think, we're doing this ourselves. They have no God. We're doing ourselves. It's not God's hands doing this. He doesn't exist. So finally, in the end of the song, God emphasizes his own majesty and his greatness, and his triumph over the Israel's enemies, and comes back to his mercy. Always returns to God's mercy and his salvation of this people. Deuteronomy 32, 39, 43. And I really like this. See now that I, even I, am he, and there is no God besides me. I kill, and I make alive. I wound, and I heal. Neither is there any that can deliver out of my hand. For I lift up my hand to heaven and say, I live forever. If I whet my glittering sword and mine hand take hold on judgment, I will render vengeance to mine enemies and will repay them that hate me. I will make mine arrows drunk with blood, and my sword shall devour flesh, that with the blood of the slain and of the captives, from the gain of revenges upon the enemy, rejoice, O ye nations, with his people. For he will avenge the blood of his servants, and will render vengeance to his adversaries, and will be merciful to his land and to his people. We have in this song Israel's past, present, and future, really. It's kind of their own mini book of Revelations, is the way I look about it. Since I found it in Revelations, that's kind of the analogy I'm making. So remember the reasoning that God gives in the beginning for teaching them the song. What did he say it was going to be? The song shall testify as a witness against them. It's bad and it's good. When Israel crosses over into the promised land, gets fat and happy, falls away, chases after other gods, becomes disobedient to the Lord over and over and over again, God will say, the song, do you remember the song? The one I taught you, the one you passed down from generation to generation. I told you what would happen. I showed you your peril. You knew the danger. You had every opportunity to avoid it. You can't say you didn't know. You are without excuse. So does that phrase sound familiar? Let's jump to the New Testament. Romans 1, 18, 21. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who hold the truth in unrighteousness. Because that which may be known of God is manifest in them, for God has showed it to them. For the invisible things of him from the creation of the world are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. Because that when they knew God, they glorified him not as God, neither were thankful, but became vain in their imaginations, and their foolish hearts were darkened. So those were the ones who fell away. They knew what was going to happen. He told them. He taught them this song and told them to pass it down from generation to generation so that they all knew. Their sons knew. And they couldn't see what was happening. It's a witness against them. But it's also a song of freedom and redemption. They're going to sing this song in heaven, this song of Moses. It says in Revelations 15. Let me read that. Revelations 15, 1 through 4. I saw another sign in heaven, great and marvelous, seven angels having the seven last plagues, for in them is filled up the wrath of God. And I saw it as it were a sea of glass mingled with fire, and them that had gotten the victory over the beast, and over his image, and over his mark, and over the number of his name, and stand on the sea of glass having the harps of God. And they sing the song of Moses, the servant of God, and the song of the land, saying, Great and marvelous are thy works, Lord God Almighty. Just and true are thy ways, thou King of saints. Who shall not fear thee, O Lord, and glorify thy name? For thou only art holy. For all nations shall come and worship before thee, for thy judgments are made manifest. The song was a witness against them. For those who were sinful, for those who fell away, It was a condemnation for them, for those who were righteous, for those who obeyed, for those who were obedient. It's a song of joy and gladness. So is there a lesson in this for us today? Are we still singing the song of Moses? Should we be? Passing it down from generation to generation? I hope so. That's what Lisa and I are trying to do with Nathan. We're passing down the song of Moses. Here it is. It's not just in Deuteronomy. It's all the way through. This is this new song of Moses. It's still with us today. We don't call it that, but we teach it. We teach it to our kids. It stands as a witness against us as well if we follow in the footsteps of the disobedience of the Israelites. Or it stands as a witness for us if we're faithful. If we're disobedient, we will be without excuse because we know. Deuteronomy 32, 45 through 47. When Moses finished reciting all these words to all Israel, he said to them, "Take to heart all the words I have solemnly declared to you this day, so that you may command your children to obey carefully all the words of this law. They are not just idle words for you. They are your life. They are your life." We're to remember the song of Moses because it is our life. It pertains to us today. Let's go back to Exodus 15:2. Remember when the Israelites were saved by God from Pharaoh's army? They sang, "The Lord is my song. The Lord is my song." And here in Deuteronomy we have, "These words are your life." The Lord is our song, and these words, or this song of Moses, is our life. The Lord is our life. We live for Him, and He lives in us. And what's more, our life is a song. It's like the song of Moses because it stands as a witness against us. On Judgment Day, our life will testify before God whether we're good or whether we're evil, for us or against us. Did we obey the Lord? Did we give Him praise and glory? Did we accept His Son, Jesus? It is a witness against us. So in closing, we're going to turn to Hosea 10:12. We're going to heed the words of the prophet. Sow for yourself righteousness, reap the fruit of unfailing love, and break up your unplowed ground, for it is time to seek the Lord. If your song is a witness against you now, now is the time to seek the Lord. Accept Jesus as your Savior, confess Him before men, become baptized, go into the world and preach the love of Christ. If you sought after the vain things of the world, things that are not of God, it's time to recommit yourself to God. Your life is a song. How does it sing? The opportunity is yours as we stand and sing.